Care Talk with Laura Packard is a podcast covering healthcare in America from a progressive perspective. Our healthcare system is broken, and we all know insurance companies are out of control. If you don't have health insurance or don't understand the differences between insurance plans or have surprise medical bills, out-of-control prescription drug costs, or can't get the care you need, listen to Care Talk with Laura Packard weekly on Tuesdays. What's going to happen to your healthcare under the Trump administration? From prescription drug prices to health insurance costs, from healthcare for seniors and people with disabilities to reproductive care, from care for veterans to public health, including vaccinations. Healthcare experts answer your questions every week, and they go in-depth on Medicare, Medicaid, the Affordable Care Act, private insurance, and more. Go to healthcarevoices.org/caretalk or search for Care Talk with Laura Packard on your favorite podcast app to listen today.
MSW Media.
Spy Talk, a podcast at the intersection of intelligence, foreign policy, national security, and military operations.
Hi there, I'm Jeff Stein. This is Spy Talk. Can a good spy become a good politician? I mean, not as an undercover agent, but in an overt way in, say, a messy U.S. Congress. Or put another way, can the skills that a CIA officer employs in clandestine operations, gregariousness, empathy, and let's face it, a learned talent for manipulating people, be put to good use in a place like the deeply polarized Congress? This week, I'm putting those questions to Abigail Spanberger, a former member of the CIA's clandestine service who in 2018 won a seat in Congress from Virginia. Since then, Spanberger, a Democrat, has developed a strong reputation for working across the aisle with Republicans on bills that help each of their constituents. And now she's running for governor of Virginia with no primary opposition. Seems like there's a very bright future ahead for this former dark arts spy. Congresswoman Spanberger, welcome so much to Spy Talk. We are honored by your presence. A few years ago, I had the privilege of interviewing a head of Mossad in his office in Herzliya. I asked him what the biggest threat to Israel was. Iran, Hezbollah, ISIS, Hamas? No, he said, to my surprise, he said it was the Haredim, the ultra-Orthodox, the ultra-conservative Jews who refused military service and formed the foundation of the settler movement in the West Bank and now the government of Israel. So you spent years working on terrorism and nuclear black markets. You've had to deal with extreme rightists around the world and terrorists around the world. So tongue only half in cheek, I asked, what's the difference between dealing with Middle East terrorists and scorched earth Trump MAGA Republicans?
Oh, what a way to start the conversation. You know, I think fundamentally in terms of my background, so working counterterrorism, the focus there was recognizing that there is an ideology that wants to undermine, disrupt, and end Western civilization in its totality, and that for terrorist organizations like ISIS, like Al-Qaeda, doing so by violent means was part of their methodology, part of what drove them.
Exactly.
When we look at some of the challenges of far-right ideology here at home, it can sometimes be easy to say, oh my goodness, like, you know, how do we come to any common ground? How do we try and determine, like, how it is that we're ever going to get on the same page? And I think an important piece is that at the core of, and I'll speak for my colleagues, right? Because that's where I do spend a fair amount of time trying to engage productively with people whose ideology is at times, I would say, extreme, or just wholly ideological. the purpose behind, or they would say that their goal is to do what they think is right by the United States. And where at times we have very, very different ideas of what it means to uphold the Constitution, what it means to recognize the threats to our institutions. And at times there might even be different views of what American society should and does and must look like.
For sure.
But I think with my colleagues, one of the important things is to endeavor to understand what might be some of the influencing factors. And I had a really interesting conversation with a Democratic colleague of mine the other day who was talking and reflecting on one of the more right-wing MAGA people who's in the news frequently. And he was saying that, you know, he was talking to this person in a casual setting on Capitol Hill. They just bumped into each other outside of votes, outside of committee meetings, and struck up a conversation. And this person asked him about a particular issue that this person had read about, you know, in the news. And my Democratic colleague said, I literally have no idea what you're talking about. Like, what is this aspect of the news? And the individual shows my colleague their phone and starts scrolling through and just says, you know, it's one kind of, as I would call it, a conspiracy, not a news source, kind of accusation of something that's occurring. And my colleague said to this other lawmaker, right, these aren't news sources. And he reported back to me in sort of reflecting on this conversation that it was actually incredibly informative for him to have this conversation where it was so clear to him in the conversation that some of the things that he had long thought was performative or truly just, you know, ideological rhetoric is also grounded in some of the misinformation that this person is receiving through social media.
Well, that's kind of vague. Let's cut to the chase here with one example from your own political career where during your campaign, you were accused of essentially being a terrorist.
Yeah.
Because you had spent time, you did a stint as a part-time teacher. Yeah. At a Saudi-funded Islamic school related to the embassy. Yeah. In Northern Virginia. And the Republicans picked up on it. First of all, they got it from a leaked personnel file.
Yep.
So someone stole your confidential personnel file.
My SF-86.
Your SF-86, the famous SF-86 every government employee knows about in this area. Anyway, and so they leaked it and framed you as essentially favoring terrorists. So one of my questions is that, you know, as a case officer, an agent recruiter is another word for it in the intelligence world, you were trained to identify people among the enemy you might turn into allies of the United States, to get them to squeal on their comrades, to turn traitor, to turn coat, let's face it. Do you look at some of your Republicans across the aisle who have embraced this extremism of the MAGA movement and say, this is a guy I might be able to turn?
Well, I think it, you know, it,
and what kind of success? Of course you do. I should answer that for you. You're trying to pick off somebody on the other side of the aisle. In fact, you were named by some think tank as the most bipartisan member of the Virginia congressional delegation. So you must be a heck of a good case officer using your case officer skills in Congress and look across the aisle and say, now, where's somebody I can pick off? Have you had any success at that?
Well, I think in looking at it and to within the frame of a case officer work. So what I found in my time as a case officer is whether somebody was reporting on a foreign nuclear program or on terrorism or on regional issues back home in their home country, the motivation was typically a desire to avoid conflict between the United States and their country, a desire to have the United States of America understand their country a bit more, a desire for stability for their country. And there were other motivations in there, a desire for, you know, to be the one bringing this relevant message, to be the one helping to inform and with information what was happening in a particular place or the plans of intentions of particular leadership. But really at the core of it was motivations in various areas or a focus on various issues. And so, you know, on Capitol Hill, where I have worked to be highly bipartisan is really dependent on the person. And so my colleagues who might have a military background or a service background, I will frequently go to them on some of the work that I've done with toxic exposures or military firefighter exposures.
So you try to find commonality in your own intelligence experience with somebody on the Republican side.
Exactly. I look at, you know, I do a lot in prescription drug pricing, and particularly my counterparts who also represent rural communities. We have, problems with rural hospitals shutting down. There's a program that's meant to help rural hospitals that many pharmaceutical companies are kind of dancing around and not abiding the law. So I'll work with those who represent other similarly rural or impacted communities. You know, really, it's a question of what's their constituency like, what's their district like, and then to some degree, what is their basic ideology like? And, you know, in my office, sometimes we say a broken clock is right twice a day. And if I can work together on one thing, then maybe I can work together on another thing.
So you try to get around these deep state accusations and all that stuff that comes out of mostly your South Side constituents down in Southwest Virginia and so on, deeply conservative, deeply red, deeply MAGA territory. And you go in and you say, I got a medical issue that you and I can work on together.
Yeah.
A community healthcare issue.
You know, some of the accusations or the divisive name calling that, that happens. It's not a regional issue in Virginia. And I have certainly seen it in all corners of my district, the most suburban portions to the most rural portions. People span the gamut regardless of where they are across Virginia and certainly across the 7th.
Of course, you go and you find allies where you can. Yeah.
We have to step away for a minute. Stand by. We'll be back. Okay, we're back.
Now, this being Spy Talk, I have to ask you about your membership and performance on the House Intelligence Committee, which, of course, you're a member of because you're a former CIA officer. What's that been like for you to be sort of flipped on the other side? And so you're supposed to be the dog catcher now.
It's wonderful. It's wonderful for a couple of reasons. I love serving on that committee because I think that I do add value to it. You know, sometimes for anyone who has spent time in the intelligence community, we get too deep in the acronyms and kind of too down the rabbit hole in discussing issues. So I think it's been valuable for me because at some times when people really start kind of using the lingo, I can pull it back and say, okay, like 50,000 foot view, let's talk through what we're talking through. Because sometimes I can hear in my colleagues' questions that maybe they're missing a vital point that might have been made. And so there's been a couple occasions where, you know, there were somebody from the committee, a congressional colleague, and one of the people testifying or answering our questions were really just talking past each other. And it was almost like they were just speaking two different languages. And so my colleague's like, you're not answering the question. And the, you know, person before the committee thought they were answering the question, but like the vocab was just wrong. And there was a little bit of a disconnect. So I think
there's nothing like the intelligence community for they're not called alphabet agencies for nothing.
And there's been a couple times too where, like, you know, we've had some folks come in and give us a little bit of a song and dance and everything sounds good. But, you know, there's some areas where I know to ask a couple more questions about this or a couple more questions about that. So I hope that I've brought value from an oversight perspective, but also, a deep and abiding appreciation for the intelligence community and more importantly, for the people who devote themselves to it. And so hopefully that's been valuable on the committee.
Let me help translate part of that. So when some of your old colleagues or maybe, you know, CIA management people, I don't mean to single out CIA, but let's just say CIA for this case, and they start putting out some spiel on something, put the nice rub on some incident, someplace, something that went sideways.
Well, not even something that went sideways, but just, you know, a lot of...
Where they're boasting about that it's fabulous and the latest, greatest thing that ever came along, and they're fabulous. And you can be a little squinty-eyed. Is that what you're saying? And say, you know, I've heard this.
Yes. I mean, not even necessarily in the negative. Sometimes there's been occasions where there's been a success that they'll talk around, and it's about, you know, let's be clear, this is what we're talking about. Right. And so it isn't necessarily a negative or a positive. There's certainly been occasions of both, but where you know, the intel community typically is not one to kind of celebrate its successes too aggressively, but from an oversight perspective, understanding what led to a particular intelligence collection success is important for the committee that has oversight, and breaking through some of the lingo at times is valuable. But, you know, also when it's, you know, where somebody might be walking us through a briefing and try to jump from A to F, you know, then I sometimes can jump in and say, what about B, C, D, E, which I can be helpful.
Well, spy novels, thrillers by former CIA officers have some relationship greater or lesser to reality at the agency. And they're full of, you know, kind of malevolent managers and screw up, uncovered screw ups and so on. So did they, in your experience, did the agencies bring them to the committee? Have they been forthright? And do your colleagues get it? Do they understand what the intelligence business is?
So yes, I mean, there's legal requirements related to congressional notification. So if and when something does go wrong, there's legal requirements. And so far, you know, we've received a number of those, and those are not necessarily screw-ups. There are certain parameters where, you know, Congress must be officially notified of, you know, certain things that happen along the way. And, you know, I think what's interesting is by the very nature of the kind of traditional intel community, so, you know, NSA, NGA, CIA, of course, those are a particular type. There's a number of people on the committee who have a DOD or military background. And so sometimes there's a lot of, I think, valuable conversations about, you know, not every purpose of an intelligence operation is to get to a military end or to enable military operations.
Right.
That much of what we do, what my former colleagues and the intelligence committee does, is to facilitate negotiations or to understand mm-hmm. how deep a threat is. It is not all for kinetic action. And I think sometimes that can be a little bit more of a challenge to explain, like, why are we even collecting this? Because particularly on the counterterrorism front, right, you collect information to avoid a threat to the United States. You collect information to stop a potential attack, et cetera. But there are many other places where you collect information to understand mm-hmm. networks of people or plans and intentions mm-hmm. of foreign governments. And sometimes I think the, like, why do we do this? And what's the end value is not always at the kind of forefront. And sometimes there's a little bit of a misaligned, I think, understanding.
Speaking of misaligned. I don't want to belabor this, but I wanted to ask you one last question. Do you ever hear, do any of these members, especially the MAGA-oriented people, do they bring this deep state rhetoric into that community, into that committee?
So, you know, typically I wouldn't necessarily speak to anything specifically said in the committee, but for this purpose, I think it's important to actually say the answer is no.
And you don't hear a fellow member say, you guys are deep state or whatever?
No. And the chairman okay. of the committee, Chairman Mike Turner, is a Republican from Ohio. The ranking member is Jim Himes, a Democrat from Connecticut. The two of them have been, I think, absolutely purposeful and thoughtful and dignified and responsible in their leadership of the committee, and have set, I think, a really important example for what is expected. That's not to say that, you know, things don't get heated, but there is a certain level, and it's a select committee, so, you know, you can be put on or kicked off relatively easily. And it's
You can be sent to sit in the corner if you do a timeout if you're obnoxious.
And so they've made clear their expectations of those who are selected to be on the committee.
Okay, I think it was former Director Michael Hayden and others have referred to the House Intelligence Committee as the home for broken toys. you hear that far amount. So anyway, that's I want to ask you about you're running.
It certainly has had its challenges. I think it's on its way up.
Tell me the weirdest thing that ever happened in one of those hearings.
Oh, I can't think of anything. I mean, they're actually typically quite boring. Well, and I would say also because with the exception of the worldwide threats hearings, most of our hearings are there's no cameras. Right. So,
yeah, thank
you
God.
Know, when you look at judiciary or oversight or some of the other committees where the antics can become viral moments, you know, unfortunately, just a commentary on Congress is that sometimes the incentives are totally misaligned from the purpose. And so, you know, if you can get a little bit of like viral recognition for some antics in a committee hearing, we've seen people kind of go that route. Because ours are classified and they're not broadcast, I think that's also helpful towards good behavior. And some of the past Congresses, you'll note, you know, they had quite a few public Intel committee hearings, and the antics were seen there. So the good thing is at least this Congress, the 118th, since there's been a major kind of overhaul within the committee. I haven't, it's not notable at all.
And finally, Congress, that's good to hear. And finally, Congresswoman, because we're running out of time, why do you want to be governor of Virginia? You've got first of all, you're a giant killer. As soon as you announced, everybody in the party ran away and said, oh my God, you know, Abigail's coming. It's like you're a Marvel comic hero, scaring everybody else out of the race, except, of course, the Republicans. But you've got to you put that seat in the Democratic column for the first time in 50 years.
That's right.
That was a headlock for the Republicans for 50 years, and then you broke that. You could have this seat forever. You could gain seniority in your particular issue areas of national security, intelligence, and so on. You might even become a Speaker of the House someday.
No.
So
let me be very
if you
clear.
Like herding cats,
I would never want that job.
So why do you want to be governor of Virginia?
Well, let me just first mention, you know, your evaluations of my my flip of my seat in when I first won it are very kind. Also, you know, rooted in fact, I am the first Democrat elected in 50 years. I have loved my time in Congress frankly, it's been a time of crisis. It's been one unprecedented event after another. I typically do fairly well in crises and crisis scenarios. And I have done much of what I set out to do, which includes legislation that I have passed, work that I have done on the Foreign Affairs Committee before I came to the Intel Committee, on the Agriculture Committee. For my constituents, I think I've raised the bar, I hope permanently, of my constituents in terms of what to expect. And I have heard just anecdotally constituents saying to the folks running for the seat I currently hold, like, you have big shoes to fill, just FYI. And so I feel proud of the things that I've done. But when I look at some of the most pressing issues that I do think have severe national security implications, the strength of our public school system, the affordability of our communities, the issue of you know, gun violence in our communities, our attention or lack of attention to issues of climate change, our investments in or lack of investments in renewable energy, like all of these things have such.
You can do on a statewide issue, you think, then you can't. You're just one of 435.
And there's a level of urgency that, you know, the General Assembly is in session for a short period every year. For a governor to get an agenda through, it is a, you know, run. It's a sprint for 4 years. And that, I think, appeals to me because I want to be hyper effective in that time. And I think that I can have real impact on both the people of Virginia, the communities I've represented, but importantly, also from an overall standpoint of, you know, American security and the strength of our communities and democracy and safety and security issues, they really do all go hand in hand. And I think that I can impact the things that I love and that motivate me every single day effectively and to a degree more quickly or more efficiently at the state level. So,
okay. Well, I hope that comes true.
The exit question is,
Virginia has a Republican governor now. It's a so-called purple state. Is the Kamala Harris candidacy, is her team going to win in November? You're a Democrat. You've got to say yes. But,
I will caveat this with, I'm not just saying this because I'm a Democrat. I actually knew by the numbers, by my engagements on the ground, by my discussions with people I know to be not necessarily driven by party allegiance when it comes time to go to the ballot box. I do assess, and then, you know, the polling data show it as well. I do assess and anticipate that Vice President Harris will win the Commonwealth of Virginia on Election Day.
Win bigger or squeaker?
I think it'll be comfortable, but it's Virginia. We're purple. It won't be a landslide. But it will be
blue on top and red in the bottom. Thank you so much, Congresswoman. It's really great fun talking to you, and I hope we have another chat down the line when you're governor.
Look forward to it. Thank you so much for having me.
And that's it for this week's Spy Talk. Thanks so much for tuning in. By the way, you can find lots more interesting conversations like this one in our archives, available wherever you get your podcasts. And if you haven't already, mosey on over to our Spy Talk newsletter on Substack, where my colleagues and I offer fresh reporting and analyses from the intersection of intelligence, foreign policy, and military operations. Just Google Spy Talk and you'll find your way there. Oh, that music you've been hearing, that's from Atomic Blonde, the 2017 action thriller starring Charlize Theron. Surely Abigail Spanberger has left that life behind, right? That's it. I'm Jeff Stein. See you around.
For more original reporting and insights like this, subscribe to SpyTalk.co on Substack and follow us on Twitter at @talk_spy. If you enjoyed our podcast, subscribe and leave a review on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
MSW Media.
Care Talk with Laura Packard is a podcast covering healthcare in America from a progressive perspective. Our healthcare system is broken, and we all know insurance companies are out of control. If you don't have health insurance or don't understand the differences between insurance plans or have surprise medical bills, out-of-control prescription drug costs, or can't get the care you need, listen to Care Talk with Laura Packard weekly on Tuesdays. What's going to happen to your healthcare under the Trump administration? From prescription drug prices to health insurance costs, from healthcare for seniors and people with disabilities to reproductive care, from care for veterans to public health, including vaccinations. Healthcare experts answer your questions every week, and they go in-depth on Medicare, Medicaid, the Affordable Care Act, private insurance, and more. Go to healthcarevoices.org/caretalk or search for Care Talk with Laura Packard on your favorite podcast app to listen today.